discuss gravity. We're going to slowly start moving towards gravity. And we'll begin by talking about the principle of equivalence. And so this principle is something Einstein called the greatest insight he ever had. And as he described it, he was sitting in his chair wondering about gravity and what caused gravity. And all of a sudden, he realized that actually he couldn't tell the difference whether gravity was pulling him down into his chair or whether somebody was pushing the chair upwards and accelerating the chair upwards. There was no possible way to tell the difference. And that essentially is the key insight behind the principle of equivalence, that gravity gravity is a phenomenon which can be described without the introduction of a new force. Okay, gravity is a property of space-time, not a separate force on particles in space-time. And that's the reason why, because all matter lives in space-time, all matter sees the same gravity. Okay, so once you realize that you can't tell if the force of gravity is due to the chair pushing you upwards and, as it were, accelerating you through space, or due to gravity, if the force is just to be being basically held where you are by the chair, and the chair is pushing you up, well, then it doesn't matter what the mass of an object is. If you hold it there, it will see the same gravitational force. And so that's why all objects see exactly the same force of gravity, because gravity is essentially a property of space-time, and everything lives in space-time. So all masses see the same acceleration. Okay, so let's state this principle more carefully. And so the principle is as follows. One imagines that space-time is a curved manifold, and we think about some point P in space-time. And the statement is that at every space-time point, it is possible to choose locally inertial or free fall coordinates such that within a sufficiently small neighborhood, the laws of physics take the same special relativistic form as they do in Minkowski. Okay, so that means when I see an object sitting on a chair or a person sitting on a chair or a book or anything, one way I can picture this is pick a set of coordinates which correspond to freely falling particles. Okay, and so I'm sitting there on the chair, but these particles are just falling under gravity. Now, from the point of view of those particles falling under gravity, they don't feel any gravity, right? That's the phenomenon of weightlessness that astronauts feel. They don't feel any gravity because they're just falling. And from their point of view, the chair is accelerating the object upwards. And so in those free fall coordinates, any sort of object would behave exactly the same. And the only force acting on that object is the normal force of electromagnetism and the other forces of nature which are responsible for mechanical forces. Okay? So that was the key insight, and this explained, for example, Galileo's observation that all objects of arbitrary mass and the whose experiment? Eötvös experiment, right? Where objects of different composition all fall at exactly the same rate under gravity. Gravitational force is independent of the composition of a body or its mass. Sorry, the acceleration is independent of its mass or composition. And this is the explanation, is that if you describe the world as a space-time within which everything lives, and the only effect of gravity is to alter the trajectories of particles in that space-time. But locally, the space-time looks like Minkowski space, and the only forces around are the other forces. Then these observations become obvious. So we think of a little neighborhood in that, on the manifold, on the region of space-time. In that neighborhood, we set up a system of coordinates, and in that set of coordinates, the space-time just looks like four-dimensional Minkowski space. So that's a sort of key principle behind general relativity, and you see it's an extremely conservative theory, okay? Basically says all the other laws of physics are right, okay? And so I'm just going to do everything I can to not to affect them. And gravity is just going to be a change of the arena in which those forces act on particles. So mathematically, what we do is the following. Let's start with Minkowski space-time. So every point is going to have a little region of Minkowski, of what looks like Minkowski space time around it, and that has a metric. It's called a metric because used to measure distances, and this metric is ds squared is minus c squared dt squared. We've already discussed this. Let's write that out. And so that is eta mu nu dx mu dx nu. And that metric can be used to measure distances. And we saw that it was very important to have this eta around just to construct the special relativistic laws, because you have to raise and lower indices and in order to construct, well, basically use eta to construct Lorentz invariant quantities. You've got two vectors. You can contract them with eta, and you get a Lorentz invariant quantity. And so we want to preserve this, keep as close as we can to this, when going to a curved space-time. And so we'll just say a curved space-time has a metric, ds squared, equals to g mu nu of x dx mu dx nu, where g mu nu is an arbitrary 4x4 symmetric invertible matrix. Okay, so to be invertible, the determinant should not be zero. And furthermore, it should have with one negative and three positive eigenvalues. Okay. And that we write as signature. The signature of a metric is the sign, the list of signs of eigenvalues. So that's minus plus plus plus. So can anyone tell me if I allowed, can the signature change in a metric while it still remains a metric? Why not? Sorry? Well, it's got to have these eigenvalues when we start, and the determinant has to stay non-zero. Okay? If it's a metric, the determinant has to be non-zero for it to be invertible. So if one of them changes sign, it has a zero somewhere. And where it has a zero, the determinant is zero, because the determinant's just the product of the eigenvalues. So you can't change a signature without the metric going singular. It'll go zero when one of the eigenvalues changes sign. Okay? If you have a matrix and its eigenvalues are lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, lambda 4, well, if these are the eigenvalues, then the determinant is just the product. Right? Because if a matrix has, it's a symmetric matrix, so you can diagonalize it. And with an orthogonal transformation. And then the determinant of the orthogonal is 1. And so the determinant of this is the product of the eigenvalues. So if one of them changes sign, you have a 0. The determinant must be 0 at that point. Okay, so whatever the sign is, whatever the signature is, you're stuck with that. If you want to remain within this framework, the only way to change the signature is to have a singularity where this description breaks down. The fact the signature is minus plus plus plus, just like eta, this means that it's actually called a pseudo-Riemannian metric. Okay, because Riemann was the mathematician who worked out the theory of manifolds in, I think, the early 19th century. And he always worked with signature pluses because he was thinking about Euclidean spaces, generalizations of Euclidean geometry. But if we want to describe spacetime, we need pseudo-Riemannian geometry, which has a minus sign. That's so that we have one coordinate that behaves like time. So if we have this, then at any point, it's easy to see that we can change coordinates to make g equal to eta. Okay? So at any point p, we'll just write down g mu nu dx mu dx nu. And let me define some new coordinates such that dx mu is equal to an orthogonal matrix times a diagonal matrix times dy mu, times dy beta. Okay, so this is orthogonal, and this is diagonal. Okay, so both of these, and I'm going to assume this is non-singular. So it's diagonal, but none of the entries should be zero, otherwise the determinant would be zero. And this is obviously invertible, because orthogonal matrix is invertible. And so this defines my new coordinate, y, in terms of the old coordinate, x. So I can just replace this with, so basically this is dx transpose g dx. Okay, it's a scalar quantity. And now I can write that dx is just od dy, So this becomes dy transpose d o transpose g o d transpose dy. D transpose is, of course, d. In fact, I had the transpose there, but that d transpose is d because it's diagonal. Now I use this to orthogonal transformation to diagonalize g. So this is going to be the eigenvalues of g. Okay. And then multiplying with d, so we're going to choose O to diagonalize g. And then we'll set d equal to d1, d2, d3, d4. And so this result here will be equal to dy transpose. And then lambda 1 d squared, lambda 2. I'm in your way, aren't I? Sorry. Dy transpose, and then lambda 1 d1 squared, lambda 2 d2 squared, lambda 3 d3 squared, lambda 4 d4 squared, zeros everywhere else, times dy. And so now I just choose my d1, so choose d1 squared to be equal to the one over the modulus of lambda 1, and etc. And so then what I have here is dy transpose eta dy. Okay, so the point is I can pick these diagonal matrices to set the diagonal elements to have magnitude 1. And then their sign is just determined by the sign of whatever the eigenvalues were. And by assumption, the signs were plus, minus, 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 or minus, plus, plus, plus. And so what we've shown is that there is a coordinate transformation such that the metric is just the Minkowski metric. And that's true at any point in space-time. So the coordinate transformation properties of the metric, well, it's obviously a tensor. It's a 0-2 tensor. Two lower indices, and so g prime mu nu of x prime should be dx dx prime. And so, for example, from this we see that the determinant of G is just given by the determinant of this product of matrices. And that's just the product of the determinant of matrices. So this is determinant of dx prime, dx dx prime squared times G times det G. Now, since determinant of g is negative, right, because it has one negative and three positive eigenvalues, so its determinant must be negative, if I can take the square root of this equation, and then what I'll get is square root of minus det g prime is equal to modulus dx dx prime. That's the Jacobian. The determinant of dx dx prime is just the Jacobian. And if I take the modulus of the determinant, it's just the Jacobian. And so now I have square root minus det g. And so it follows that the integral over spacetime d4x, okay, so that's integrating over time and the three space coordinates, times the square root of minus det g. Okay, so that's, and if I prime those quantities, then this is equal to the integral d4x of square root minus det g. And so in other words, square root determinant times d4x is a coordinate invariant quantity. Okay, this is a scalar or coordinate invariant quantity. And so when we come to write down all the laws of physics in their most concise form, they will involve an integral over space-time. Okay? So in fact, let me just write them down now so you can anticipate all the rest of the Psi program. Okay? You can write all the laws of physics in one line. Okay? All the laws we know about. And so let's start off with gravity. So what I do is I integrate over space-time, root minus g. We'll have a term due to Einstein. And next week we will be studying this term. That's called the Ricci scalar. That measures the curvature of space-time. And then we will have a Maxwell term, which you already know. Okay? Turns out the Lagrangian, or the action for Maxwell's equation, is just that tensor F squared with a factor of a quarter by convention. So this is Maxwell. Okay, so that's electromagnetism. So now we've got gravity and electromagnetism. And what about the strong and the weak force? Well, those are very easy. Just put some indices on here. Okay? The strong and the weak force look like that. Okay, essentially these indices here describe a group. This F mu nu A transforms under a symmetry group, like you just studied with Pedro last week. And the group here is U1 times SU2 times SU3. So this is the weak, this is called the electroweak theory. It includes electromagnetism. And this is the strong force. And the combination is the grand unified force. Well, this part is more speculative. We don't know if the forces really unify. We're sure about this part. But what you can see is it's just a copy of Maxwell, okay, with a little bit of group theory. Okay. Have you ever seen this term? Anybody seen anything like that? Who invented that? Dirac, okay? So that's Dirac. And I'm not going to teach you about Dirac, but you'll do that in quantum field theory. The only point I'm making here is because we have this description of a curved space-time, we can actually write the action down for Dirac. And then there's a term like this. This is due to Yukawa. It's the term which gives all the particles their mass. And then there's another famous Scot called Higgs. And so Yukawa invented this term. It actually has a constant there. This is called the Yukawa coupling. Just a constant. It's a matrix which gives the masses to all the particles in the standard model. And then the final term we have are the Higgs Lagrangian. Okay, and I'm not going to define these derivatives very carefully, but basically those derivatives are determined by this symmetry. Okay, so that's it. That's all of physics. All right, so during this course, you will learn what each of those terms means. And it's quite nice because you don't have to remember anything apart from relativistic notation. And then, you know, if you got shipwrecked and you're on a desert island, you have to work out all of physics, you just need to remember this formula. Everything follows from this formula. Yeah?
Is it a task to do calculations using this formula of the actions if all terms are present?
You have to remember what these things mean. Yeah. This one? Just alpha, beta, alpha, beta. That's a scalar.
What about the extra?
Oh, this A?
Yeah.
Oh, this A is a...
It
has no relation to the others. So you have an F. And there's an A. It's actually a little bit awkward where to put it. So these two indices get contracted. And these are just internal indices. They're not space-time indices. It's just like, what is it like? It's, you just have copies of the F, okay? But you can rotate them into each other because, you know, say I write down some quantity A, right? And if there are N of those indices, then I could do orthogonal transformations which preserve this product. Those are not space-time transformations. They're called internal transformations. So these indices, they are internal. Having said that, there are ways of explaining the internal ones as being due to extra dimensions of space. So those explanations, in fact, these internal dimensions are a reflection of more dimensions of space than the four we did. What's that?
I said, I only just figured out the space-time.
Oh, well, don't worry about it. The other ones won't occur in my course. They're going to occur in particle physics. All of particle physics is about the other ones. Okay? The whole of particle physics is about these guys. So when I write down this psi also has some indices. It has some space-time indices, but it also has some internal indices. It turns out it has a different kind of index from these ones. This is, let me call it something else, not to confuse it. Well, I don't have enough symbols. There's a space-time index on a spinner as well. And there's also an internal. And basically when you do space-time operations or internal operations, everything transforms in a certain predefined way. And that is, in fact, the entire logic behind the standard model. It should be invariant under the Lorentz transformations, and it should be invariant under the internal symmetry operations. And that's it. And that's the most fundamental understanding we have of the laws of physics. Yeah. No, this is... what is it? This is the action. This is the action. And, you know, so when I have an action, what do I do with it? I vary it with respect to the fields, and that gives me the equations of motion.
Say, I don't find the derivative
of this equals 0. Exactly. So delta S equals 0 this corresponds to the classical field equations. Okay, the variation being zero for arbitrary variations of the field gives you the classical field equation. Now, that's only the classical theory. When you do the quantum theory, the amplitude for the state of the universe to go from A, some state, in to out, okay, is given by the path integral. So I integrate over the fields. It's a functional integral over all these fields. And then I multiply by e to the I action over h bar. That's Planck's constant. And boundary condition is that the fields start out in the in state and then come out in the out state. Okay, so that's really the summary of all the laws of physics. Okay, and this amplitude's obviously Lorentz invariant and coordinate invariant and everything because the action is. Yeah.
What kind of object is symmetric? It contracts to take vectors to functions or.
It just raises and lowers indices. That's all it does.
But I mean, it's not a two form, is it? Because it's symmetric.
No, it's symmetric. It's a symmetric concept. Okay, so that's just to give you some motivation for this metric. It's a very, very important thing, obviously. Now, it's by definition non-singular, determinant's not zero. That means it's invertible. And so we define the inverse to be, so the inverse G alpha beta G beta gamma. So the inverse is the G with upstairs indices, just like eta. And this is delta alpha gamma. So G with upstairs indices is the inverse of G by definition. And G prime mu nu transforms using the inverse transformations to G with downstairs indices. Just as happened with the lambda. Okay, so remember when I had lambda and lambda twiddle, lambda transforms upstairs indices, lambda twiddle downstairs indices. Dx prime dx is the analog of lambda. It transforms upstairs indices. Dx dx prime transforms downstairs indices. Okay, so this is all just a straight copy of Lorentz invariance, but only at a point, at any point. Okay, so you can use the metric G alpha beta or G mu nu to raise or lower indices. And so, for example, T alpha mu nu is equal to G alpha beta T beta mu nu. Okay. So when you think of a tensor, in fact, you should sort of think of it modulo all of this. So any tensor I can express with downstairs indices, or I could put some number of the indices up. I have to be very careful, as I tried to emphasize last time, to keep the indices in the same order horizontally. Okay, so if I move some up or down, I still need to keep them in the same place horizontally. Okay, because those indices may actually mean different things. They may have different symmetry properties, for example. So the order matters. So you'll notice here that I keep this. This alpha is there in the first position, and I don't write this, okay, because then I wouldn't know where is alpha relative to mu. I have to write it like that. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Not C prime. This is just raising and lowering with G. I'm not doing a coordinate transformation. I'm just raising and lowering. Coordinate transformation is this guy. Okay? So in a given set of coordinates, I have my T and I have a G, upstairs and downstairs. And I can raise and lower my coordinates in that coordinate system. Yeah, but that doesn't give me a prime. Eta doesn't involve a Lorentz transformation. Yeah.
So G is not like a...
G is not a coordinate transformation. G is like eta. And the dx dx prime, dx prime dx is like lambda. In fact, it is lambda. If x. G is a function of x. So that's an extra complication, is that, yeah, maybe I should have put that in here. X prime, this is g of x. Okay, so what's happened is that the eta, which was this constant matrix, has become a dynamical quantity. It can change in space-time. And all you should insist on is that its eigenvalues are minus, plus, plus, plus. And that's it. But the eigenvalues can change, and they will change. Yeah.
Okay, I have a simple question. So when you have a metric, you lower and rise indices, so mm-hmm. that's like you change from a vector to a covector or back
yeah.
and forth, right? Like,
yeah.
It's like, why does a metric do that? Like, what does it physically mean? Like, you have a vector.
What's the physical difference between a vector and a covector?
No, like, what is the metric actually doing that changes a vector to a covector? I don't quite see it.
It's there to make sure that the laws you write down are invariant under coordinate transformations. That's all. See, when you introduce coordinates, you're doing this completely horrible thing. We've got this beautiful manifold. It's a lovely, smooth structure, right? The laws of physics only depend on that structure. And now, but we can't describe it without the others. So we put numbers on it. We put coordinates on it. But we know these coordinates don't mean anything. Right? They're just a useful tool, like the letters in a book. And if I change all the letters, if I change A to C and B to F and D to Z in a book, right? The meaning of a book should be the same. So G is just something you use. It's an instrument you use to construct a set of laws that don't depend on the coordinates.
Yeah, I know. But
so for example, the distance. Just the most simple thing you can do, right? Measure the distance between two points. How am I going to do that? Well, I have to introduce some coordinates. So I introduce my little coordinate grid, okay? And now I measure the change in coordinates from one point to the other. Then I say, well, what's the distance? Well, the distance is g. dx mu dx nu, right? And so g, these are not coordinate invariant. The coordinates are not coordinate invariant. So I had to introduce something that's not coordinate invariant in order to make something that is coordinate invariant. And so the coordinate transformation of this guy and this guy precisely cancel.
Dx goes to lambda, so goes to the Lorentz transformation. So is there not no such thing as a general Lorentz transformation for a field space?
Well, that's what the x prime dx is. So x prime, if x prime is linear in x, if x prime is equal to, so if g equals eta, so let's work at some point, And let's work at some point. So I pick coordinates so that g is eta. And then I ask what coordinate transformations remain. So I pick my coordinates so g equals eta. I can ask what is the residual coordinate freedom left if I want g equals eta. Well, that's the coordinate freedom so that eta prime is... dx prime dx, dx prime dx, eta, that should be eta. okay? And that is precisely the Lorentz transformation. So if dx prime dx equals lambda, which is a constant, then it follows that x prime is equal to lambda x.
Another local frame.
What do you mean by local frame? Do you mean at a different point?
Yes.
Yeah, they're all different. So just think about it point by point. So another way of saying this is, you see, G is not a physical thing. I mean, G is a 4x4 symmetric matrix. It has 10 components. But you shouldn't think of those components as physical things, because I can change coordinates. I've got 4 free functions to play with. Four functions of x, y, so that my t prime can be any function of t, x, y, z, and the x prime in any function. So I have 4 free functions. So the g, I have to at least lose 4 of those. So only 6 of the components of g are actually in any way physical. And then it turns out actually even less than that.
That means that you can, on every patch, you can choose such coordinates such that G is equal to E3.
Yeah, I proved that. Yeah, so I proved that. I proved that if I pick, see that part is easy. That if I pick a G at any point is just a 4x4 matrix, and then what I say is that was G in some coordinates x. Now just pick x prime to be d o x. Okay, that's a linear change of coordinates, right? And what I've shown you is that g prime will now be eta if I pick these guys correctly. So point by point, I can change coordinates and make it eta.
You can diagonalize g with a clever choice of coordinates, but don't you have to assume that g varies smoothly next to the
inner? No. I did this only at one point. I picked a point, I've got G at that point. I changed coordinates to make G eta at that point. That's all I'm claiming. I'm not doing it, I can do it independently at each point. Now, when I've picked those coordinates, the G nearby won't be eta. Okay, because there'll be derivatives of G. All I've worked out is the matrix G at that point I can turn into eta.
The metric near the point where it diagonalizes be very near to.
Yes, it will be near, but its derivative may not be zero. So now it will turn out that you can still pick coordinates to make the derivative zero, the first derivative zero, but you can't pick coordinates to make the second derivative zero. And in fact, this curvature of space-time depends on the second derivative of the metric. Okay, but we'll get to this. These are all good questions, but we will get to them in due course. Are there any other questions? Yeah.
I have a sort of conceptual question about the principle of equivalence. Like, if what we're considering is that gravitation is the same thing as an accelerating frame, how can we say that that's like a Lorentz invariant?
The point is we're getting into this question of the derivatives of the metric. Okay, when I wrote down that action, so I've written down all the laws of physics. The point is that at one space-time point in that Lagrangian, there's a G. So, if I was doing special relativity, I'd write down this Lagrangian with an eta, and then it would be invariant under Lorentz transformations. But all I do to go from special to general relativity is replace the eta with a g. Okay, that's all you do. And you're guaranteed by this general formalism that it's general coordinate invariant. Okay? Now, let's get to your question. So you're saying, repeat your question.
So, yeah, it's sort of like what we started with here.
You're wondering about the equivalence principle. Yeah. Why is gravity equivalent?
So we call gravity an accelerated frame, but we say that it's locally inertial. Why is it locally inertial if we're thinking about it as an accelerated frame?
So what the statement is that statement of the equivalence principle is that it is possible to choose coordinates that happen to be accelerated. Okay, it's possible to choose coordinates such that the laws of physics locally don't mention gravity. That's the statement of the equivalence principle. And that's what I've just shown you, that if I have this G, and then I can choose coordinates at any space-time point, such that G is just eta. And at that space-time point, if I write down the laws of physics, they will agree with special relativity laws of physics, because the G I have will just be replaced by eta. Okay, so this whole thing is just a means of ensuring the equivalence principle. You invent this G, you show that at any point it can be, by choice of coordinates, it can be made into eta. And then you make sure you write down your laws of physics only using G and contractions of G. And that just guarantees that at a given point, the laws are special relativistic invariant. Yep.
So if you have students and they have different laws of physics, but they
That would again be a statement about derivatives. Okay. So basically there's this notion that the manifold is smooth, and so then there's this notion that around any point it looks flat. Okay, so a pseudo-Riemannian manifold by definition in the neighborhood of any point looks like Minkowski.
If
it's not smooth,
yes.
Yeah, then the whole thing falls apart. It doesn't make any sense. Okay, that's undoubtedly true. So this picture of a very smooth space-time is, as I was saying last time, is kind of inherently incompatible with the notion of a quantum gravity or a fluctuating space-time. So what you have to hope is that the approximation of smoothness is the reasonable one. Okay, so smoothness emerges as an approximation. But this is exactly how quantum mechanics works. You see, if I sum over paths in quantum mechanics, if I start at position x1 and I go to position x2, then according to quantum mechanics, the typical path will look like this. Okay? But we sum over all those paths. And so you do some huge sum over an infinite number of paths. And then it turns out that the sum has a saddle point. So the saddle point is a trajectory around which a trajectory which basically dominates the sum. Okay, and so there's a trajectory called the classical trajectory, which will approximate the answer of this infinite sum. And so that's the idea of quantum gravity, that there. Classical space-time is really due to the interference between all these different paths that space-time is taking. And you see we have the e to the is over h bar. So it's an oscillating integrand. And basically you have all these different paths, but when you add them all up, the jagged bits cancel out, and you're left with a smooth answer. So nobody's been able to make that work for gravity, but that's the hope. Yeah. Yeah, it's a good question, and you know, even experts change their minds about this. Okay, so you'll notice I insisted the determinant of G is not zero because I wanted G to be invertible. So there's now when I do the sum over paths, what's going to stop one of those eigenvalues changing sign? I mean, if I just integrate over all the components of G. Something might change sign, and the determinant should be zero. So there's a famous paper by Ed Witten in which he claimed that 2 plus 1 quantum gravity does allow that to happen. Okay. And then 10 years later, he retracted it and said, so this is a contemporary issue. It's not resolved. But if you want to do classical GR, just because you need a metric with downstairs and upstairs indices, you have to insist that the metric is invertible. So there will be some singularities where the metric is not invertible. There are other singularities where the curvature of space-time goes to infinity. There are other singularities which are simply where the notion of a manifold breaks down. There are many kinds of singularities. There's a famous relativist called Bob Garoch, and his entire thesis is on the definition of what is a singularity. And it does not reach a single conclusion. There's no, a boundary of space-time is a singularity in some sense, right? Because I get there, and what next? It doesn't look locally like a piece of Minkowski space. I've reached the edge. That's not like Minkowski space. So that you would call a singularity as well. So there are many types of singularities. Okay, let's do an example. Bring this down to earth a little bit. And so just, I'm not going to do a four-dimensional manifold. Let's just do our two-sphere again. So imagine that we are Riemann, and we're doing a Euclidean space. So this has signature plus plus. Okay, so both the directions on the sphere will have positive eigenvalues in the metric. And we already did this, so we're in Euclidean three-dimensional Euclidean space. So x is sine theta cos phi, y is sine theta sine phi, z is cos theta. So that defines the surface of the sphere. These are the embedding of the two-sphere into three Euclidean dimensions. And then let's ask, what is the metric on the two-sphere? Okay, so the metric just gives you the distance between any points on the sphere, and we can get that out of the Euclidean space, because I'm in Euclidean space. So I draw my sphere, and then I take my two points, and I just compute the distance between them using the embedding coordinates. Okay? So the metric is induced. We say it's induced from E3. Okay? And you can calculate it. It's just dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. And that's just equal to d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. Okay, so to do that calculation, all I do is say take x and then say dx is cos theta d theta cos phi plus sine theta or minus sine theta sine phi d phi, etc. And just calculate dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. And you'll get this, which is the distance on the sphere. And so the metric on the sphere in the coordinates theta phi is, so g mu nu is equal to 1, 0 sine squared theta. And so you see the problem at theta equals 0 or pi. The metric is singular. That's another sign that the coordinates are bad there. Because you know there's nothing different at the poles than anywhere else, so that obviously the problem is with the coordinates. And if I calculate the square root of the determinant of g, that's sine theta. And you know that from elementary calculus, that the volume element of on a sphere is d theta d phi sine theta. Right? And so basically when we develop this tensor calculus, then all the stuff you learned about how to do calculus in spherical polars or cylindrical polars follows very easily. Okay, it's just a special case of a general coordinate system. And so I'll just give you an exercise in projective coordinates on the two sphere. So remember z1, z2, these were the coordinates on the plane obtained by shining a light down from the North Pole. I guess I could call this x over 1 minus z and y over 1 minus z. And then the metric ds squared is 4 dz1 squared plus dz2 squared over 1 plus z1 squared plus z2 squared squared. And or I can do this in polar coordinates for the z1, z2 plane, 4 over 1 plus r squared squared dr squared plus r squared d phi squared, where r squared is z1 squared plus z2 squared. Okay, so all we're doing is rewriting this metric inherited from the Euclidean space the surface lives in, and we're just rewriting it in different coordinates. You might wonder, can any metric be embedded in a Euclidean space of higher dimension? And, you know, so do I really have to think about this metric sort of on its own terms as an intrinsic object, or can I stick it in a space of higher dimension and, as a surface? Does anybody know the answer to that question? Two n is enough. So the first theorem is something called the Whitney theorem that says any manifold as a topological space can be embedded in something of 2n dimensions. I think that's the one you're talking about. But then there's a second theorem due to John Nash. Do you know The Perfect Mind, the film? Beautiful Mind. Perfect Mind. So The Beautiful Mind. So that person proved the a theorem called the isometric embedding theorem. So he proved that you can stick a manifold into a Euclidean space in such a way that the metric on the manifold is exactly the Euclidean metric coming from the embedding space, just as in the way I did the sphere. So he proved you can always do that for some dimension of the Euclidean space. Okay? And there is an upper bound, but it's very high. It's extremely high. So I think for four dimensions, the upper bound in pseudo-Riemannian metric, in four dimensions, the upper bound is 90. Okay. So, but it's there is a theorem. So this is the Nash embedding theorem. Every differentiable manifold can be embedded in En for some n. Exactly. Yes, the Whitney theorem doesn't refer to the metric at all. But Nash proved this theorem for the metric. Can be embedded, I didn't say it properly, can be embedded isometrically. That's the crucial statement. And isometrically means you just take the metric in the Euclidean space and induce it on the manifold, and that gives the right metric. So what it tells you is that if you like, you can think about GR as describing a surface floating around in a higher dimension. That's a perfectly good way to think about GR. It may not be necessary, but it's a perfectly good way to do it. And that will cover any possible circumstance, any possible manifold you might encounter. It's a notoriously difficult theorem.
Is there an easy way to embed the Minkowski space in
EM? Why would you want to embed Minkowski space?
Like, differential, but.
Yeah, okay, so if I put a pseudo here, I said differentiable manifold. That's in mathematical jargon, that will generally, let's see. Okay, I've got to be a little bit more detailed. So this would be Riemannian. That means signature plus, 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 plus. Or pseudo-Riemannian, Riemannian. Okay, there are two cases. Either you're Riemannian or you're not. And in those two cases, you embed either in some Euclidean space or in some Minkowskian space. Or some, if you have a different signature, it would be a different one. Okay. And the details are quite tricky. So I believe that you can show that the most general one can be embedded in a Minkowskian space with at most three minus signs. Okay? So it's not straightforward. It's not just that you need one time. Okay. So we've got our metric, and so that's the first step towards writing the laws of physics so they are locally special relativistic. Okay? To have a metric which is equal to eta, can be made equal to eta by a choice of coordinates at any point in space-time. But the next point, and so basically then we will have all of tensor calculus that we had in special relativity, right? So we had objects with upstairs indices and downstairs indices, and we had G. We could raise and we had eta, we could raise and lower indices. Now we clearly have the same, except at any point of space-time. The next step is to take derivatives. Okay? So we don't want just tensors, we want derivatives of tensors. We want to be able to do calculus with tensors. And to do that, we need a new ingredient, which is the connection. So if I have some scalar, phi of x, in space-time, that is a 0-0 tensor, then I can obviously construct a derivative of it. And this indeed will be a 0-1 tensor. Okay? And that's easy to check because d by dx prime, phi of x prime, will be equal to dx dx prime, d by dx, phi of x, just by the chain rule, because d by dx prime is d by dx 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 prime. Okay? So that's the correct transformation law for a tensor. So derivatives of scalars are fine. We don't need anything else. But as soon as we do anything more complicated, like this, let's say I had a vector. Okay, this is not a tensor. Let's check that. Let's prime everything. Okay, and then so d by dx prime is dx dx prime, d by dx. So let's put the indices in. And then v mu prime is dx prime mu dx beta v beta of x. Okay. And so this, well, if I differentiate the v, I get the right kind of term. I get dx alpha, dx prime nu, dx prime mu, dx beta, dv beta, dx alpha. And that looks good, because that's exactly the transformation law for a 1-1 tensor. One index up, one index down. The down index got this guy. The up index got that guy. So everything's good. Only problem is there's another term here. So this is good. But the other term is differentiating this x prime twice with respect to x. So then I have plus dx alpha dx prime nu d2x prime mu dx alpha dx beta v beta. And that's bad. That is not the tensor transformation law of the derivative of the vector. So we cannot take derivatives of tensors and get tensors back without some new object. And so we introduce a new object to cancel the bad term. And that's what the connection is. This is the connection. And once we have it, it allows tensors of any valence to be differentiated. To produce new tensors. Okay, and basically Riemann's main discovery was that there is a more or less unique connection, and I'm going to explain exactly what more or less means. Okay, so the connection is defined to have a transformation law. Of the connection is at first sight and maybe second sight a pretty disgusting thing. So the first term in its transformation is the nice term. So gamma is the connection, and it has one upstairs index, which transforms with dx prime dx, and two downstairs indices, which transform with dx prime. Okay, so that's just the transformation law for a tensor. But because its purpose is to cancel the bad term, gamma should not transform like a tensor. Okay, it has to transform with an extra term which is designed to precisely cancel things like this. And the extra term turns out to be unique, and it looks like this. So that's the transformation law of this object gamma. It's definitely not a tensor. What I want to point out to you is that note the anti-symmetric part of gamma actually is a tensor, because partial derivatives commute, right? So this is a symmetric under, this is equal to d2x lambda dx prime rho dx prime nu. You can take derivatives in any order and they commute. And so the symmetric part, the anti-symmetric part of gamma, this would cancel. This term would cancel. So gamma mu nu rho minus gamma mu rho nu is a tensor. Okay? And that is the torsion. That is called the torsion tensor. And that's a kind of real legitimate object. And you can do anything you can do with any other tensor, you can do with the torsion. It's called T nu rho mu, the torsion. Okay. And it's an interesting physical question whether the world has torsion or not. Okay, and the answer will be that it does, but the torsion is very small. Okay, so the founders of Riemannian geometry, like Riemann, just assumed it was zero. Okay, but in fact it's not zero in the real world. It's not zero. We know that, but Riemann didn't, and so Riemann assumed it was zero. But I'm going to derive things for general torsion, because there's no reason just to stick things zero just because you find them annoying. Okay, so here is our transformation law of the connection. It's also useful to write that second term in another way. We have this. Just by the chain rule, the differentiate, if I write this down, okay, so this just means differentiating, oops. Yeah, sorry, that's right. In a funny way. Mu. Okay, this, as we've already discussed, that's just dx prime rho by the chain rule, and so that's delta mu rho. Now, I can differentiate this again, and I'll get zero on the right-hand side. And so by differentiating this, you can show that dx prime mu, actually let me write it in the same order, d2x lambda dx prime nu dx prime rho dx prime mu dx lambda equals minus dx lambda dx prime rho dx alpha Okay, so I just take this equation and differentiate with respect to x prime nu. Okay, so the first term I get is this one. The second term I get is this one, differentiated with respect to x prime nu. And the differential with respect to x prime nu, I can rewrite as that. Okay, so this is d by dx prime nu. So I'll have the sum of two terms equal to zero because the right-hand side is independent of x prime. And so it follows those two terms must be equal and opposite. And so this term over here, I can equally well, so it's expressed as two derivatives of x with respect to x prime. I can equally well express it as two derivatives of x prime with respect to x. Okay, those two forms are entirely equivalent. And often it'll be useful to use either one form or the other form. So what you can now show, so we have this transformation of the connection, and what you can show is that, let's consider our basic consistency condition for a differentiable manifold, that if I change coordinates from x to x prime and x prime to x double prime, this should be just the same as going from x to x prime, x double prime. Okay, they better agree. Okay, and if you write down some transformation law, you better make sure that if I work out gamma double prime this way, or I work it out that way, I should get the same answer. Okay, so I start with my gamma, I go to gamma prime, and go to gamma double prime, or I go this way. And so I think I won't go through this in detail, but if you look in Houston and Todd, they do this calculation. It's quite straightforward, but lots of indices. And so basically what they show is gamma double prime is the same gamma double prime. Let's see, you get the same gamma double prime for x going to x prime goes to x double prime as for x going to x double prime directly. Okay, and the fact that you're consistent in triple overlap regions is a very important check that you defined something sensible. So I'll just leave you to read that. It's in, can't remember the chapter number, which I don't have. Where do I have it? Here. It's page 53. Okay, so I recommend you work through that just to check you understand what's going on. And now we have this connection, all right? It is a notion, right? I just introduced some fictitious object which transforms in the right way. So I've got the notion of a connection. I can now differentiate tensors. And tensors to get new tensors. So it's kind of not hard to see how this works. We had gamma prime equal to dx, 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 gamma. Like that. And then we had a dx, dx, d2x, dx, dx. Prime, 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 got primed. And I've already showed you that if you just look at the transformation law of a tensor, so let's say I take D, I've also proved that this is equal to minus this thing, which was dx dx prime dx dx prime d2 x prime dx dx. Okay, so now let's look at the derivative of a vector, a contravariant vector. And I'm going to introduce a little bit of notation. Let's call dx prime dx will be j, just like the lambdas in Lorentz transformations. And the dx dx prime will be j twiddle, which is the inverse of j. So when I do this transformation, what do I get? I get j twiddle, because the d by dx prime transforms as a lower vector, as a covariant vector, times d. So I'm just going to not bother to put indices in. Okay, so you hopefully see the bones of the argument without spending too much time on it. And so this is clearly going to be j twiddle j dv plus j twiddle v dj. Okay? And the first term was the good term, and that second term was the bad term. The derivative of j, which gives me two derivatives of x. But we also have, well, I think I'm almost there. So this this term here, what is this term? This is j twiddle, j, dj. Right? Because j is dx prime dx, and d by dx of it is dj. And so you can see that if I write down gamma prime v prime, that's equal to j twiddle, j twiddle j gamma. All right, this guy here is j. J twiddle, J twiddle. That's a twiddle. Times V. Maybe let me put these indices here so you see where they are. Here's my index on V. And now gamma has three indices, so let's write this down. And the upper index is going to be nu. Okay, so what I'm doing is using gamma to create something with two indices, one up and one down. So I'm acting with gamma on something with one index up. I just contract one of the lower indices, and I produce something with one up and one down. So at least the indices look the same as in this term. So I have this transformation term, and then if I use the second form, I'll have j twiddle j dj v. And let's see, these two should cancel. All right. That is V prime. So sorry, I did this a little wrong, because this is gamma prime V prime. But remember, V prime is J times V. V prime, V transforms like this, so it's JV. Right? This is the term from gamma prime. This is JV. And so here I have JV. And V prime is JV. Oh, these are two J-twiddles, yeah. I've got too many J's, sorry. That's correct. Okay.
Why do you need the J before the V?
Because V prime is JV, right? V nu prime is equal to dx prime nu, dx alpha, V alpha. That's J. Sorry, there's too many J's and J primes. Gamma prime like that. Yes. So the point is this J and that J twiddle, J and J twiddle are inverses, so this will make one. This will make a delta. And have I got the right number here? I've got J. This should have been a J twiddle. DJ, J twiddle, DJ. That's right. There's a J. And so a J twiddle and a J will make a delta. And this minus sign will cancel this term. OK, so both of these terms are identical. So these two will cancel. Okay, so I'll just leave it to you to check the indices. But you can see that I have the right terms to cancel. And likewise, let's quickly do the downstairs V. Oh, so just to summarize, what I did is I computed D prime V prime, and I got this horrible term. And then I computed gamma prime V prime, and I got a horrible term, but it's exactly the same one, but with a minus sign. And so it follows that d mu prime v mu prime plus gamma mu alpha v alpha mu, sorry, nu, yep, that quantity, all primed, is equal to d mu v nu plus, sorry, that's equal to the right tensor stuff times d mu v nu plus gamma alpha mu nu v alpha, i.e., if we define this kind of derivative, so this is a Nabla, Nabla mu v mu, it's a generalization of the derivative. If we define this to be that object, then this is a tensor, 1, 1 tensor. Okay, and we can also see, similarly, d mu, let's say u nu, some, if I differentiate some tensor with a lowered index, then the right formula to get a tensor is, turns out to have the other sign, minus gamma alpha u alpha mu nu is a 0, 2 tensor. Okay, and to prove this one, you see you need the minus sign there. To prove the second one, use the first form of the gamma prime transformation. So the gamma prime transformation will give you a minus term with d2x, dx prime, dx prime. And this term will give you a plus term with d2x, dx prime, dx prime, and they will cancel. Yep.
It also because JFibble and JR are primers.
Yes.
Yes. So why the other way, the first time J fibula, why is
this one?
Exactly below that.
Sorry?
Last line.
Yes.
The first time on the right side.
This one.
J fibula, yes. J fibula, J fibula, gamma, JB.
Right.
You cancel J fibula with J, but you don't cancel J with J fibula. Why?
Yeah, that's because the indices work out right.
So we cannot say.
No, you're right. You need to work the indices out. Yeah. Just work the indices out. So you need to check that this index, this has one index contracted with here. That's correct. I haven't shown that. I'm just showing you how the sign is going.
So during the tutorial, you'll do the exercise.
Yeah. In the tutorial, you'll do this in an exercise. Okay. I think you only want to do it once in your life.
Okay. We've already done it.
And you can probably believe it. It's worth doing once. But hopefully I've made it plausible. So let me just end by giving you the general rule. That if I differentiate a tensor with let's imagine I try to differentiate a tensor with one lower and two upper indices. Well, the rule is just a generalization of this. So the upper indices, so first of all I get the ordinary derivative, the nu alpha beta. The upper indices come with pluses, so I've got to contract, basically I contract those upper indices with my gamma, v nu gamma, with this connection, and each upper index gets separately contracted. And then I have the beta index has got to be contracted, alpha, gamma, beta, and then the downstairs index is contracted in the other way. So here I have gamma, mu, v, gamma, mu, alpha, beta, okay, i.e. plus gamma for each upstairs index. Index and minus gamma for each downstairs index. So that's the general formula for the covariant derivative. I just want to point one thing out to you. One easy way to sort of bear in mind, because you'll notice these contractions of the gammas are a little bit different for the ups and the downs. Just think about the following. When I take derivative, it has some index mu, right? That's got to be on the right-hand side. There's got to be a mu, okay? My convention is I always put that mu second in the gamma. Okay, so that mu is the first one you should write down when you write your gamma down. Okay, the gamma comes with that. The last of its downstairs index should be the derivative index. Okay, then it's unique. Whatever else you do is unique. Okay, so I have to contract gamma with this v for this upstairs index, the second upstairs index. So I take the second upstairs index. I've only got one thing to contract it with, right? One downstairs index. I have to contract that with that. That's the only thing I can do. And then I'm left with then basically this index, which is the one I'm contracting, is on the upside of the gamma. And likewise, when I look here, I've got my derivative index. I'm trying to contract this index with the gamma. I have to contract it with the upper one because it's lower. And then I'm left with the new down there. So it's completely unique once you agree to always put the derivative index last. And this is actually very important when you define torsion. You have to pick a convention and stick to it. Okay? Any questions? Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Sorry. Not very good at that. Yes. Exactly there to cancel the non-coordinate free. It's exactly there to cancel the bad behavior. So it must behave badly. So the connection itself has no interpretation as a sort of physical object. I mean, what means a physical object? You know, I've told you G is not a physical object. In fact, no tensor is really a physical object. But if I take some tensors, let's say I've got some vector, maybe a couple of vectors, and then I contract them with G. Well, that's good, because that's coordinate independent. So that quantity, if these depend on space-time, G and U and V depend on space-time, I can contract that. That's completely independent of coordinates. So that is a function. It's a scalar function. It lives on the manifold. I can say at this point P, U dot V equals that number. And doesn't matter what coordinate system I use, I have to get that number. So that's a coordinate invariant quantity. Yes. So the only invariant quantity, well, there are some other invariant quantities, but the only sort of obvious local invariant quantities are contractions of tensors. And so if I take gamma, you see, I could try and do this with gamma, too. Let's imagine I had some vectors around, and I form this U nu. Well, that's not coordinate invariant, because gamma isn't a tensor. So this bad transformation law, which will mean that this quantity depends on whichever coordinate system I use, this can't possibly be a physical quantity. I mentioned there are other coordinate invariant quantities, but they are non-local. So for example, I could say, let me choose this manifold, and I actually go and measure the length around some curve, right? Or I could, we'll see this later, you can transport some vector around this curve and see how it comes back. That you can define as a coordinate invariant quantity. But so those are non-local coordinate invariant quantities. And then generally people who try to describe, if you want to describe gravity in a coordinate invariant way, you very quickly force to these non-local variables. It's very difficult. When you use coordinates, you can do things locally, but the variables you're using are all redundant. I mean, they don't... typically don't mean anything. Only certain particular contractions of them mean anything. Okay. So there's an example class this afternoon?
Yes.
At 3.
So the tutorial at 3:30.
Tutorial at 3:30. Good. Are there any other questions anybody has?
Yeah, I have one, Neil. It's on the rule of torsion in space-time. If you have torsion, then you can't use the Levi-Civita connection because you're torsion, obviously. Yeah. So you'd then be forced to look at an extended class of gravity theories called the Einstein-Cartan theories. Now, to my knowledge, that wasn't very popular, so why is it that we have torsion in space-time? Or is it an observation of cosmology or something?
We're actually forced to have torsion. This is usually ignored in the textbooks. But we know it's there, okay? So, you know, this is something when I was learning GR, I always found very annoying. People assume that the connection is symmetric.
Uh-huh. that's what I
without justifying. Okay. Now the correct statement is that the anti-symmetric part of the connection is a tensor. So you can think about that as a real physical thing. I mean, albeit you're going to have to contract it with some other vectors to get a coordinate invariant thing, but at least you've got something there. Okay, the anti-symmetric part is a tensor. Now, the assumption made by Riemann and then Einstein and all the early people was that the torsion is zero. And in a way, that's not such a bad assumption, because if torsion is zero in one coordinate system, it's zero in all coordinate systems. Okay, so at least it's kosher. I mean, it's a covariant rule. However, why did you set it zero? I mean, that's completely arbitrary. And it's not a very principled thing to do, to just say, oh, there's this quantity, I'm going to set it zero. And what was discovered later is that when you couple gravity to fermion fields, then, so we have this term, psi bar id slash psi, which I haven't written out explicitly. But it turns out when you couple this to gravity, that actually it's just inconsistent to set the torsion equal to zero. Okay? The torsion turns out, we've defined torsion is something like this, right? One up, I guess I should be. You've got to try and be careful. Usually, when we write gamma, so I always told you to put the indices horizontally in the obvious position. So you really should write gamma like this. Okay, but usually we don't worry about that, and it's as long as we keep them in this order, it's fairly clear which is which. But you do really have to be careful about this with torsion. So I'm going to write the torsion like this. And in fact, I'm going to lower that index. Okay. Now the torsion, by definition, is anti-symmetric on those two indices. Okay, but not on this one. So that's a different index. It's an example. So sometimes people do a dot there to show you don't mix these indices up. These two guys are anti-symmetric. That's not. And then you find that if you have fermion fields around, that actually the torsion is equal to mu, nu, rho, lambda, with some number here, times j lambda 5. This is the spin current for the fermions. Okay? So if I've got a neutrino going through this room, the spin current basically tells me the flow of left-handed, the number of left-handed particles, or number of right-handed minus the number of left-handed particles. So I've got more neutrinos going this with a spin this way than that way. Okay, this is not zero, and the torsion is not zero.
So that's part of the spin connection is torsion.
Sorry?
We've inferred that the spin connection is torsion. The connection in the D fermion term
absolutely
is torsion.
Yeah. So, and actually we'll do this next time, but it will turn out that there's another tensor called the contortion tensor. And let me see. Yeah, no, actually, sorry, so just say it from here. The special property that seems to be true is that the torsion is totally anti-symmetric. Now, probably there are generalizations of that, which I don't know about, but if you just take fermions, they give rise to a source to the totally anti-symmetric part of the torsion. You can't set it zero. So in that sense, Einstein and all the other people were lucky. They basically said, oh, there's this ugly thing. Let me set it zero. And it's very, very small. Okay, so because we don't have huge amounts of left-handed neutrinos flying through the space. And so they were just lucky. That's a good approximation to say the torsion is zero. But that is not zero, really. Yeah.
Okay. Isn't the torsion being zero, isn't it associated with the prevalence principle?
No.
As the torsion is a
no.
tensor, but
no.
if you have
because
a geodesic equation, you'll never be able to
yeah.
reach away.
Particle geodesics do not see the torsion. Right? We'll come to this, but the geodesic equation, the equation of motion of a freely falling particle, will look like this. Okay, this is the equation for a free falling particle in space-time. And this is symmetric, so the torsion doesn't occur. So torsion does not affect the paths particles take in space-time. But it still comes into the equations of motion. So if I work out the equation of motion of some field, electromagnetism or whatever, they all involve covariant derivatives and the torsion will appear. It's just really, really hard to detect.
So Einstein just said that the torsion was free. That it was easier?
I think Riemann is another way of saying it, you see, and it relates to the derivatives of the metric.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So, what we showed is that at a point, you can set g mu nu equal to eta mu. What about the first derivative? Can I, you know, if I want something to be locally like Minkowski, the derivative of the metric is zero. So if I want to be like Minkowski, can I actually set the first derivative of the metric? So g is eta, but can I set its first derivative also equal to zero? So, so it turns out you can do that. There's enough coordinate freedom to do that. And so in a sense, you would say the unphysical part of the metric is this thing, right? The derivatives of the metric. First derivative of the metric. It's not really physical because locally I can set it zero. Okay? Now, if you look at the number of components of this, this is a symmetric tensor, right? And then there are four more indices. So the number of components here, a symmetric 4x4 has 10 components, and then there's a row index. So this has 40 components. That's exactly the same number of components as the Christoffel symbol, right? If I say it's symmetric, okay? If gamma is symmetric, then this also has 40 components. So in other words, gamma is not a physical thing, and neither is the first derivative of the metric a physical thing, and they're the same thing if you say gamma is symmetric. And even in algebraically, we'll see that if we set the covariant derivative of the metric to be zero, that's equivalent to... and we say gamma is symmetric, then it turns out gamma is uniquely expressed in terms of that. And so if gamma, if this is zero, that is zero. So really these two things are in correspondence. Okay? Now when you have torsion, it's a little bit more messy because only the symmetric part of gamma has 40 components. The anti-symmetric part has 24. So there's another 24 components lying around in gamma. Physically, they are not zero, and it's just wrong to set. I mean, you look in all the textbooks, they say, we're just going to assume gamma is symmetric. I mean, this, I don't know why people do that. It's just, it's not correct, and we know that gamma is not symmetric. Yeah.
Let's say the torsion was very large, then how would
we see it?
Yes.
It's a good question. I don't know. You will not see it in the motion of particles. I guess we do know. You will see it in the motion of spins. So as particles move along a world line, okay, the particle, and I guess that's why this makes sense. Okay? So as a particle moves along its world line, it's got some spin vector that it's traveling along with. And as it travels through space, that spin vector will move around. And we say that the spin vector is parallel transported along the line. And so basically that means that d sigma mu d lambda plus gamma, the same old Christoffel symbol, alpha beta dx alpha d tau, let's call it tau, sigma beta is zero. That's the equation for parallel transport. And you see, now I don't have this. Now the torsion will matter. because this is not symmetric under exchanging alpha and beta.
Is that Papa-Petrus equation?
Sorry?
Is that Papa-Petrus equation?
This one?
Yes.
No, that's just the equation of parallel transport. This is parallel transport. That's just saying if I've got some curve, if I've got a geodesic, in fact it's true for any curve, if I've got a curve x of tau, and I've got a vector defined, I've got a vector, then this is the definition of how you, well, what you mean by transporting this vector along that curve in a parallel way. Okay, and the torsion will come into that. So these neutrinos will actually, or any spinning particle will feel the torsion. The trouble is this is absolutely tiny. So I know of no application or area in which this torsion is important. It's a real pity. One day somebody will figure out how to measure it. But it's very small. I mean, the world is full of neutrinos. There are 100 neutrinos per cc in space. Cosmic neutrinos, right? But they're really tough to detect. Much harder than the photons. So, yeah.
I'm trying to crack a little bit. The first root of J is a tensor, but the Christoffel symbols are not tensors by definition, so I don't really understand what you mean when you say that they're in correspondence.
Sorry, this?
Yeah.
You mean these two?
Yeah.
Well, neither of them are tensors.
They're not.
The derivative of a tensor is not a tensor. G is a tensor.
I thought you meant the covariant derivative.
No. Okay. No, I mean the ordinary derivative.
Okay, right.
Yeah. So the ordinary derivative of G is not a tensor, and neither is this a tensor. And they're in correspondence.
Okay.
They're in exact correspondence if the torsion is zero. If the torsion is not zero, it's a little bit more complicated. But they're kind of morally in correspondence because they're the same number of degrees of freedom in both of them.
Don't you generally use a symmetric connection when calculating a geodesic?
No, the point is that even if it has an anti-symmetric part, it wouldn't matter. Because, okay, so if I have let's imagine I have a completely general matrix, not symmetric, I can always write it as the sum of the symmetric part and the anti-symmetric part. So the symmetric part, I just exchange those indices. And then the anti-symmetric part, I put a minus sign. Minus gamma lambda nu mu. Okay, so those two terms just cancel. So that's the symmetric part, that's the anti-symmetric part. Now, if I look at the geodesic equation, the anti-symmetric part gives zero, right? Because I'm contracting it with dx nu detour, dx lambda detour. But that's exactly the same if I flip the indices lambda and nu. So this is a symmetric quantity. When you contract,
I thought you were saying it with respect to parallel transport. Because
no,
it's equivalent to a geodesic at one point.
No, so this is the geodesic equation. So the statement is that the geodesics are insensitive to the anti-symmetric part. But the parallel transport, for example, of spins, is sensitive to it. So if you wanted to measure the torsion, that's what you'd have to look at. Not just the path of a particle, you'd have to watch it, how its spin got transported through the universe. Yeah?
So if I have a scalar field on the manifold, if I want to try to define a covariant derivative, the torsion term would appear. That's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So the connection is not totally... you don't have a weakness of connection with just the metric, you'll have the...
Yes.
The metric and the torsion to the
point. Yes, and it's a little bit more complicated the way it works out, because what you do is you write down an action for this fermion, and in fact, when you write down the action for fermions, you can't use the metric, because the Dirac equation is only one derivative in the Dirac equation, and G has two indices. So you can't use G. You've got to work out d by d mu of psi. You're not allowed to use another derivative. You've got to write down something coordinate invariant. So what you do is take the square root of the metric, okay, which is called a Fierbein, and you contract that with the derivative. So now you've got this new action, which involves G and, roughly speaking, its square root. And then you vary this action, and when you vary it, you find one of the equations of motion, determines the connection in terms of G, in terms of this square root of the metric.
When you say square root of the metric, you mean expressing the metric things so that spin-order
function? No, I just mean if I have G, I write it this way. So I have a general 4x4 matrix. I can always express it as...
You find out another autonomous system.
Okay, and so now when you write the Dirac equation, basically it looks like this. And if you try to make this general coordinate invariant, you put a index on the gamma, and then you have mu a, so those indices get contracted and like that. Okay, but the short answer is that when you take the action for a fermion, you vary it, you will get an equation of motion for the Christoffel symbol. It's actually determined by the action, you see. So the statement torsion is zero. It's the same as if I'm just being lazy, I've got some dynamical system, and a couple, some degrees of freedom. And I'm just going to set one of them zero. Okay, it's just laziness. But if you actually vary it and get the equation of motion for it, that will fix the variable. And the statement is that if you don't have fermions and you vary the Einstein action, a possible solution of the system is to have the torsion zero. That's allowed. If you have fermions, it's not allowed. The value is not zero. Yeah. Okay.
So the lectures in the Hisro and the tutorials.